Thank you and for the opportunity to be here. For those of you who don't know what grass looks like, there's some in the sand hills in Nebraska. I'm located at the West Central Research and Extension Center, which is right here where at the confluence of the North and South Platte Rivers are, then flows over into our eastern border of the state, which is the Missouri River. I'd like to point out, though, all these stars on this map are where we have beef cattle research being conducted. So I think there's a lot of states that have decreased their commitment to the beef industry, and Nebraska has only grown it. I think we've added 35 jobs in the last 3 or 4 years, and Ronnie Green tells us there's another 20 on the way. So that's part of the reason I'm still at Nebraska. North Platte is really the epicenter of the beef industry. We feed over half the cattle in the state here, and Nebraska is number one in all red meat production. The Goodmanson Sandhills Laboratory up here, I'll be talking about research going on there. This is the largest cow-calf county in the United States, more cows and calves there than any other county in the United States. And a lot of variability in this environmentally from west to east. We have more variation in rainfall than we do from the eastern border of Nebraska to the east coast. So a lot of irrigated ground in our state, which makes it somewhat drought resilient. I saw some green areas flying into Sacramento, so I assume that's the same. Our largest beef operations, 13,000 acres, about 700 cows. They're a composite crossbred Simmental Red Angus deal. This ranch lies in the sand hills, a combination of upland sand dunes and that are stabilized, more warm season grasses, and then these sub-irrigated meadows, which are largely hayed but often grazed as well. We have this research, or this extension facility, the Wagon Hammer Center, was given all by private funds. We'll have a couple thousand people go through there every year, and you're not ever going to cross the Goodmanson Sandhills Laboratory unless you're going to go to Keneally's Bull Sale, perhaps. We have a dorm facility. Somebody asked me if I had grad students. I do, and I'm always looking for good graduate students, but we have a facility there to house them. One of the unique things, I think, with our research is we focus on systems research, looking at relevant questions that producers might have, but as you're going to see, not just end there. We finish all the steers that go into the system. All the heifers are evaluated for pubertal status prior to breeding. We breed every female on the place or expose them anyway, and then we'll calve them, and depending on the study, when that study ends, whether they're retained or not. Our work, I'll tell you this topic, we did not start out ever investigating this topic I'm going to talk about today. It came as a byproduct of the systems research. I've had the opportunity to travel quite extensively throughout the United States and actually South America a couple times last year, but we've written a book chapter on fetal programming that appears in one of Brazil's main beef production resources. I got a chance to go to both Sao Paulo and Buenos Aires last year. Tell you down there, Dave Patterson knows, Cliff Lamb knows, they AI a lot of cattle. If you look at assisted reproductive technology, they are embracing it probably much more than we do here. And a lot of it's due to labor. We talked to Dr. Lauderdale, did a great job talking about some of the products that are available to the industry. They do not have implants, but they have estrogen. Is that a dichotomy? So consequently, they finish most of their cattle in the form of bulls. These are intact Nelore bulls in a feedlot, quite docile. It was my experience when I was there. Over half their cattle now spend some time on feed. They're the number one in all cattle numbers in the world today. And if we think about them, we know there's restrictions of it's being lifted currently, right, of importation of beef from Brazil, but we definitely are competing with them on the world market, and they are a player in the industry for sure. Well, if we look at some of our costs and relevant questions producers have, you know, we're going to go after the big ticket items, and feed is number one. Feed is the biggest cost of production, bar none, bar any part of the beef industry. So some of the initial questions we look at is, can we extend grazing? We do get snow in Nebraska. Can we decrease harvested forage needs by extending grazing? And then what's the need to supplement these cattle when they're grazing this dormant forage? So at a time when forage quality is declining into the winter time, one thing that's happening, especially in our spring calving herd, is we have the majority of fetal growth occurring. So that mismatch, the questions become, what are the consequences? This first study looked at two different weaning times, either August or November, and then supplementation during or within each of those weaning times. Do we need to supplement protein? And that becomes the first limiting nutrient in a forage that's below, what, 7% protein, Scott? Our nutritionist can make all the corrections I screwed up in the next talk, right? So we look at the effect of weaning date on body condition. We see these cows that are weaned early maintain greater body condition and are in greater condition at calving. And then if we look at breeding, they're more close together. Why did we make that decision of weaning time? It's to an outcome for that cow, right? Did it help her breed better? And no, it did not. Same with supplementation. Do we need to supplement those cows grazing winter grass? And that was the other part of this study. Those cows not supplemented were in here below a condition score 5 for sure at calving than those that were supplemented. And supplement was a pound of a 42% protein. So we maintained greater condition with supplementation, but did we improve the outcome we were supplementing for? And again, there's about 12 to 14 years of data. We show no benefit of supplementing that cow for the reason we think we're supplementing her, to get her bred. But I think the key here is what's happening from calving to breeding. This is absolutely key. They have to exhibit that increase in body condition or gain going into breeding, or I think we're going to have a whole different effect. So here's some of the cows that were on those studies. We take all the calves and they go to North Platte to the feedlot where they're finished. And it wasn't until we started to look at this data that we thought maybe we're affecting something else. So here's these calves that are weaned in November with no supplement compared to November with supplement. We took 100 pounds off those calves by what we did to their mother during late gestation. We didn't impact reproduction, and those early weaned cows much less affected than these cows that were weaned late. We decreased live weight 100 pounds and carcass weight almost 60 pounds by something that happened before that calf was ever born. We do economics on all our studies, and I'll just bottom line, the most profitable system if you go to finish was to wean in November and supplement. The next study looked at the same overwinter treatments, but we looked at what was the effect on the heifer progeny. We also had some post-calving treatments that were largely, there was no effect, and so I won't be covering that today. But we wanted to see if we needed to supplement protein during late gestation for the benefit of that heifer, but we also looked at the steer calves. Three-year study, we try to get good numbers on these cattle. There were probably over 300 cattle in this study or probably close to 400. Running age cows, that might be important. Natural service breeding, a pound of a 42% protein cake that was delivered 3 times a week. These heifers got the luxury of spending the winter in Fargo, North Dakota. Before we put our Kalen Gates system in. And Kim Bonomi was a co-author on this paper where we looked at feed efficiency of those heifer calves. Here's some of our heifers that John talked about. I think one of the reasons people don't develop heifers like this is why you don't want your neighbors to see them. We're good stewards of the land and the end of our cattle. Do you like those heifers? No, you don't. How about those? They're the same heifers. Those heifers are identical heifers in the fall. That compensatory gain thing, you know, that the yearling industry depends so largely on, also works in heifers, turns out. So again, we saw no difference in supplementation effect on pregnancy rate in this study. We did, however, affect these. I might qualify one thing in this study. The previous study, we weaned those calves in November. These calves were weaned in October, and I think body condition has a lot to do with explaining some of these different effects. And these calves weaned in October, there, I guess you could argue, isn't even a tendency, but numerically had lower live weight at harvest. But those cows would have been in better condition. But these cows that were supplemented actually weaned more live calves. So just go to some of the heifer data. Weaning weights were depressed in heifers from cows not supplemented, as were adjusted 205-day weights and weights at pregnancy diagnosis. So maybe that isn't a bad thing. Maybe our cattle are too big and there's some environmental thing that might include a management practice pre-calving that can suppress animal growth and make a smaller cow that's more efficient. We don't know that. But if we look at reproduction, which is what we were really interested in, those heifers that were from cows that weren't and were supplemented, no difference in age at puberty and cycling percent, two things we think are pretty important in predicting pregnancy outcome, not different. But those that calved in the first 21 days, a dramatic difference in overall pregnancy rate, 13% lower if that heifer came from a cow that was not supplemented during gestation. Look at another resource. We got the highest grass prices probably in the world today in Nebraska. And I think it's really prohibiting some of our younger people entering the beef industry with this huge cost of entry if we're going to go into a traditional summer grazing system. As a beef group, one thing we're looking at is how can we utilize more of this? This is the cheapest feed resource we have in our state. And we only utilize about 20% of it or less. So we're looking at opportunities to graze more of this and then maybe harvest more of this and use it in some of our cow production systems. But we graze a lot of corn stalks in Nebraska, bottom line. So that's potentially a viable alternative to overwintering cattle if we have access to them. So we wanted to look at what are the implications of the supplementation treatments, not only on winter grass, but what about corn residue? So the two treatments were winter range or corn residue with or without protein supplement. And this time we had about a pound of a 28% protein cube. And John alluded to the bypass protein deal, and Eric can address this more. But it seems to us, not with direct comparisons, but that we can supplement less effective total crude protein and get the same response with some higher percent bypass protein. So here's some of the cows. Snow isn't a problem. Grazing corn residue, the cows will go through it. Ice is a problem. So again, over a three-year period, 340 head of cattle. Running age cattle, again, natural service breeding. Here's the supplement, if any of you are interested. It was a two-thirds distillers-based supplement, but also contained monansin and trace minerals. So, you know, visiting at the break, that we haven't titrated all these things out. Do they all collectively affect this developing fetus? And probably likely so. And which are most important? We know the first limiting nutrient grazing dormant forage, though, is protein. And we had better correct that initially. The calves came to North Platte, at least the steer calves did. The heifer calves, we 1 year went to North Dakota with them, and then we installed some kaolin gates and were able to measure feed efficiency. So cow performance. You guys probably aren't big corn stalk grazers out here, but when I talk to people, it's amazing that they don't really know what cows do better on, winter grass or corn residue. Actually, the two top bars are on corn residue, and this is winter grass. And this is with and without supplement. We never even saw a response to supplementation for those cows grazing corn residue. Just the absolute weights. We did see a response in weight in those cows on range with supplement, but not with corn residue. And here's preg rates, mid to upper 90s again. No benefit of supplementing that cow for why we think we're supplementing her. I don't want to go through all this data, but calving distribution, you've heard mentioned today how important that is. This is the most nutritionally challenged treatment, the no supplement winter range. The one thing we did see was a lower percent of calves born in the first 21 days. They got pregnant, but they got pregnant later. steers in the feedlot. We took 70 pounds off those calves before they were ever born, if they were on a cow that, or if they came from a cow that wasn't supplemented. Grazing when arranged, not so with corn residue. And then similar, whatever dressing percent, carcass weight was reduced. So again, like the first study, quality grade, this all-important thing called marbling. Here's percent choice, here's upper two-thirds choice. We decreased both in both systems before those calves were ever born. I had supper a week or so ago with my good friend Larry Cora at CAB, and I talked to him at a previous time, and he wrote a white paper on why cattle aren't grading better, and I said, you need to add a chapter. What happened to that calf before that calf was ever born? And this probably has some real relevance to what's going on in your country, that happened in Texas, that happened in Nebraska. These cattle that went through extreme drought did not just impact themselves, but those calves that are inside those cows. And I've got a lot of questions on that, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. We've installed a GrowSafe system at North Platte to measure feed efficiency. Which do you think are more efficient, calf from cows that are supplemented or not? Turns out the calves from unsupplemented cows are, and it's interesting if you think about it, that calf developing in a nutrient-restricted environment during gestation is being programmed to utilize nutrients more efficiently. In humans, there's a condition called thrifty fetus, in which women that are malnourished during pregnancy have children that have diabetic and obesity problems. Some of the heifer calves, again, they were less efficient if they came from a supplemented cow. We look at pregnancy rate of those females that came from cows without supplement, both on winter range, or this is pubertal, let's go to pregnancy. No supplement winter range, no supplement corn residue. Those heifer calves were affected, fertility was affected before they were born. So we just talked about heifer development from birth to calving, but what about prior to birth? Bob Cushman at Mark is trying to look at some of the mechanisms by which, and George I think has worked on this too, that by which nutrition is being translated even during gestation to lower fertility in the females. And I think he has some work that shows these restricted females have lower antral follicle counts as one possible explanation. So we talked about feed efficiency. Those heifers born to cows that are not supplemented, actually, depending, I guess, regardless how you express it, are less efficient. So grazing corn residue, we really see no benefit of supplementing except on marbling in those steer calves. Protein supplement for cows on winter range definitely affected everything except the outcome we were supplementing for, right? For their breeding or rebreeding. And one thing I wanted to just talk about for a second here, and this is in the paper, but protein supplementation, regardless of grazing system, affected calf morbidity in the feedlot. I got an email from Bert Rutherford, I think, and it was from a talk that Tom Brank gave somewhere, and he said over the last 10 years, we've had more sickness in calves in the feedlot than we've ever had. And he said, could this be due to some of this drought and translated into this fetal programming? I think it's possible. I think possible there's a lot of other reasons, too. But largely over, I ask the pharmaceutical companies everywhere I go, how much advance have we made in BRD over the last 25 years? And the answer is zero. We got better treatments, but we haven't decreased the incidence. We've done some work, and we published two papers this year. Not a lot of this is in the proceedings, but looking at first calf heifers and then two different supplements, one high in degradable protein and one high in undegradable protein. And we see, we put these heifers in, bred heifers in Kalen Gates' system and had these different supplements. We affected weaning weight, and we affected clear to carcass. We affected ether extract, Warner Bratzler's shear force, percent choice by the supplement that those calves received during gestation. There's other work going on. Andy Roberts, whose name's been alluded to in our previous talk, has done some work. And and actually getting at some of the effects on longevity, which we've not been able to really get at. But in his heifer development system, they've got two different, you know, development levels, and the cattle go to a certain target weight. John presented some of this data, but it's interesting, depending on those development systems, now they have daughters out of those cows that are either restricted or controlled. And finding that this restricted combination is actually producing a female that has greater longevity. And I think we see that in other species, some challenged animals that might be on the borderline of nutrition actually having greater longevity. So is there an epigenetic effect? I believe there is. And these restricted had lighter birth weights, lighter weaning weights. So is this system now responding to the environment by adjusting genetics to fit that environment, by lowering production perhaps? Improving feed efficiency, reducing the feed per pregnant heifer, does it improve longevity? And he mentions here, is this a potential way to improve drought resistance, matching genotype to environment, which suppresses milk in a limited resource environment, right? He says there is a real distinct uniformity of these cattle in these treatments. You look at these four Keogh cows. They're also a composite Red Angus-based female. So the consequences of nutrient restriction must be considered not only for the individual animal, but also for Junior here that's not even born yet. There's been a lot of work looking at mechanisms. It appears to be related to blood flow. What are the exact mechanisms or particular nutrients involved? A lot of hypotheses. The human literature is full of this, right? Why wouldn't we think it would be happening in our farm species? I mentioned the thrifty phenotype. We know about cardiovascular disease and diabetes and offspring from women in varying nutrient states during gestation. We've known about it in women for a long time. This woman worries about the jackhammer noise down the street on her unborn child, not to mention insert your favorite brand of cigarette here. A rancher gave me this book after he heard me talk about this, and I'm impressed by the ranchers I work with all over the United States, but a lot in Nebraska. And he was interested in this concept, and this medical journalist documents cases of malnutrition, overnutrition, and how it impacted the children during development, but also some rather immediate tragic events that some pregnant females might have went through, like 9/11, that after 9/11 there were more girl babies born than boy babies. That there's a group of Aboriginals in Canada that don't have enough boys for a basketball team, that live in the vicinity of an industrial plant that skews the sex ratio for perpetuation of the species to produce more female offspring. George Seidel can explain to you the mechanism because I don't understand it, but it's interesting. And what about the victims that went through the hurricanes and floods and all these that were pregnant? Is it just that short-term effect on that mother or father? It's probably lasting for generations, perhaps. I don't have any male data. I hate to go to the lab anymore. I spent my time in grad school there, but why wouldn't we think we can also have some effect on the male? This study was done in which they made these male mice obese or normal, fed mice, and they mated them to a random population of females and found that the pups sired by this big dude had developmental problems in the form of they've got some cardiovascular problems, some metabolic problems during development. This is something that happened before conception occurred that affected that DNA and was translated to the offspring. This is a slide courtesy of Kim Bonomi. It says, drinking, smoking, taking prescription meds, or failing to eat a balanced diet can influence the health of men's future children. Tim Evans, if you're in the room, you better be careful. Sorry if you don't know Tim. But I always get this question, Lauderdale. I'll step on the edge with you for a second. What about these overdeveloped bulls? What are we doing? What about these overdeveloped bulls that ABS or Select Sires or Genix buys and takes back to the stud that they can't collect for 6 months? Did I just say that? So, which bodes the question, when did Michael Phelps become a good swimmer? I heard he's cracking back out, so to speak, right? All right, thank you for your attention. From the heart of the sand hills in the heart of cattle country, Dave, this is also David Patterson's favorite slide set. Here's 896 bred heifers on the Rex Ranch. I've never heard that response come from David Patterson, but this is the best beef website in the world. That's a pretty bold statement, ain't it? I tell people, send me a better one. This is a collaborative effort and contribution by our entire beef team, and I don't know of a source that has much more relevant across all discipline areas of beef production. So with that, I think we're right on time.